From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Obama trip to Asia worries Beijing. India's latest electoral battle features high-profile candidates. Thailand's political turmoil impacts its economy. These stories and more on this Thursday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. In India, opposition prime ministerial candidate Narendra Modi and ruling Congress party leader Sonia Gandhi were among the contestants in polling Wednesday in India's national election. As the electoral battle for a new government enters its final stages, the contestants are pushing hard to gather votes. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi.
Despite soaring summer temperatures, enthusiastic crowds turned out to vote in the western state of Gujarat. The home state of Bharatiya Janata Party prime ministerial candidate, Narendra Modi. After casting his vote in a school in Ahmedabad city early Wednesday, Modi flashed victory signs to cheering supporters. The man who polls say could be India's next prime minister exuded confidence, saying the elections will end the rule of Congress Party President Sonia Gandhi and her son Rahul Gandhi. Modi told reporters he has gauged voters' mood with his own eyes. The opposition leader says nothing can save the mother-son government. He says polls held so far have set the foundation of a new, strong government. However, the BJP leader sparked controversy, flashing his party symbol Lotus and giving a speech after voting. Following complaints from his opponents, the Election Commission ordered action against Modi for violating the code of conduct, which does not allow canvassing outside places where polling is taking place. The Hindu nationalist leader is contesting from two seats, Vadodara in Gujarat and the Hindu holy city of Varanasi in Uttar Pradesh. Gujarat was among nine states and territories in which 89 constituencies went to the polls Wednesday. These included the Rai Bareli constituency in Uttar Pradesh, from where the top Congress Party leader Sonia Gandhi is contesting. With the Congress Party's fortunes appearing to wane, Sonia Gandhi's daughter Priyanka Vadra has joined the poll campaign in recent days to revive the party's fortunes. The Nehru-Gandhi political dynasty has dominated Indian politics since independence from Britain in 1947. But political analysts say Rahul Gandhi, who was catapulted to prominence in this election, is a lackluster campaigner and has failed to halt Modi's momentum. On the other hand, observers say his sister is more charismatic and connects much better with voters. Priyanka Vadra campaigned on Wednesday in Amethi in Uttar Pradesh state, from where her brother Rahul Gandhi is contesting.
Rahul Gandhi has a forward-looking vision that will bring development to the area, such as roads to boost business and new train connections. The Gandhi family's newest campaigner has been countering Modi by calling the election a fight to protect India's secular identity. It is a reference to concerns that the Hindu nationalist leader is divisive, an allegation he has faced since 2002 when his state was racked by sectarian rioting. The BJP in turn has pointed to Vadra's husband, who is alleged to have amassed a fortune in property transactions in recent years due to his political connections. The Congress Party's waning support is partly due to allegations that corruption flourished under its rule. Political analysts say the campaign is becoming increasingly shrill as both sides pull out all stops for the two remaining stages of the mammoth nine-stage poll, which ends on May 12th. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
We invite you to stay tuned as we meet the author of the new book, Asia in Washington, later on Daybreak Asia. State-run Chinese media say a terrorist attack on a railway station in western Xinjiang province has killed three people and wounded 79. Police say the attackers slashed people with knives and set off a bomb, apparently between the station exit and a bus stop in the capital of Urumqi. Chinese President Xi Jinping, who had just ended a four-day visit to Xinjiang Wednesday, immediately pledged decisive actions. He said there will be no slack in the fight against violence and terrorism. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack. Xinjiang is home to China's Muslim Uyghur minority. The Uyghurs accuse the central government of violent repression, while Chinese authorities accuse them of waging a terrorist campaign for separatism. A stabbing rampage in a railroad station in Yunnan province last month killed 29 people. Authorities blamed that attack on Uyghur separatists. During his trip to Asia, U.S. President Barack Obama assured Japan that Washington would come to its aid if tensions over disputed islands with China ever boiled over. He also signed a new troop rotation pact with the Philippines, leading some to call the trip the Contain China Tour. VOA's Bill Ide reports from Beijing, where few appeared convinced by Mr. Obama's assurances that Washington is not trying to halt China's peaceful rise.
President Barack Obama's Asia trip was widely seen as an effort to bolster security and economic ties in the region, leading some in Beijing to ask why he would not stop in China. Mr. Obama's vows of support for Japan and the Philippines led to widespread Chinese media coverage that the trip was instead aimed at stalling China's rise, despite his assurances to the contrary. China's foreign ministry spokesman told reporters on Wednesday that Beijing has good reason to ask Washington to explain its new security pact with the Philippines and why that does not harm regional stability. During his trip, President Obama was careful to stress that the new agreement with the Philippines was mainly for military exercises related to and dealing with humanitarian relief. University of Hong Kong's Reyes says the search for missing Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 and last year's devastating typhoon in the Philippines have highlighted the need for strengthened U.S. presence in the region and stronger regional security architecture.
It's not inconsistent with what the United States is already doing in the region, this idea that military-to-military ties are essential. You need to develop them in a region that really has no security architecture comparable to what you have, say, at NATO.
At the same time, Reyes adds, the U.S. needs to pursue deeper military-to-military ties with China. But some in the United States argue that too much focus is put on China and not enough on what benefits Washington's allies in the region are providing for America, says Clyde Prestowitz, a former U.S. trade negotiator and president of the Economic Strategy Institute.
Is China a threat to Japan and Korea and the Philippines and Malaysia? And I think one could say no. But even if it were, is it a threat to the U.S.? And I think the answer is definitely no. So if the answer is no, then why are we providing protection, or what benefit does the U.S. derive?
When the Chinese government was asked what it thought of the fact that President Obama did not visit China during the trip, the foreign ministry played down the significance, saying, regardless of whether he comes or not, we will still be here. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Violence 25 years ago is being remembered in Hong Kong, where a permanent museum dedicated to the Tiananmen crackdown of 1989 has officially opened. Organizers say a quarter century after the events, Chinese people need to know more about what happened and call on Beijing to face its troubled history. Rebecca Valley reports from Hong Kong for VOA.
The exhibition is the world's first museum dedicated to the brutal crackdown ordered by the Chinese leadership 25 years ago. While references to the crackdown are banned on the mainland, activists and politicians in Hong Kong have long called on Beijing to offer a full account of what happened on June 4, 1989. Li Zhuoren, chairman of the Hong Kong Alliance in Support of Patriotic Democratic Movements of China, is one of the organizers. He says the media blackout has left younger generations in the dark. He says they're very confused about what happened in Tiananmen. They should come to the museum to learn more about June 4th, so they can carry that knowledge and the spirit of the students' movement back to China and strive for democracy. The museum is organized as a maze with pictures and written accounts of the events leading up to the crackdown, when the government ordered the People's Liberation Army to shoot at protesters. In 1989, Chen Qinghua was a representative sent by the Hong Kong Student Association to support the student movement, which had been demonstrating for months against corruption and calling for political reform. He says that in the late evening of June 3rd, he was at a medical station near Tiananmen Square, and what he saw filled him with disbelief and anger.
Starting from 9:10:30, 11 o'clock, people bore gun wounds. Some of them are dead on arrival. We are so shocked on that. You never prepare for that.
An official death toll has never been made public, and estimates range from hundreds to thousands of dead. The government in China says the protests were counter-revolutionary and insists that China has moved on from that political turmoil. The last 30 years of development, Beijing says, show that the country has reached a clear conclusion on those events. The museum, which opened Saturday, ran into some opposition. The building's owners' committee tried to block the opening with a vote earlier this month, an effort that organizers say was due to pressure from mainland authorities. On Saturday, pro-Beijing protesters stood outside the museum's building, holding banners suggesting violence was started by the student movement. Rebecca Valli reporting for VOA News, Hong Kong.
China is a fascinating country.
With interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own, American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia. In Thailand, there are more signs of how the country's prolonged political deadlock is affecting household finances. Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok on a university survey on rising debt levels among lower-wage workers.
The University of the Thai Chamber of Commerce survey found more than 90% of laborers earning less than $500 a month are increasingly in debt, often needing to borrow funds to meet even basic daily requirements. The university's economists say levels of forced borrowings by laborers outside the banking system are at their highest levels in 6 years. The survey reported that Thai household debt now accounts for over 80% of Thailand's total national output, from just over 50% in 2008. Asian Development Bank senior Thai economist Laxman Attapit says the high rates of debt are impacting consumption, undermining economic growth.
Because of this high level of household debt, it means that households will have to pay for debt, and that part of income cannot be used for consumption. If we look at the rate of NPL for household debt, we can see that it is rising a little, which means that households are paying debt, and it will affect household consumption in 2014, as it affected already in 2013.
Thai labourers' concerns also include loss of employment, rising costs of living, and continuing political uncertainties that are causing some foreign investors to put big investments on hold. Economists say that Thailand's slowing economy, forecast to grow just under 3% this year, could lead to some 600,000 unemployed, which would be the highest number in a decade. Thailand's months-long political deadlock still shows no signs of a breakthrough, and the caretaker government lacks the authority to set economic policy. In response, influential business groups such as the Thai Board of Trade and the Thai Chamber of Commerce are adding their voice to calls for a return to parliamentary democracy amid the poor economic outlook. Chris Baker, an author and commentator on Thai business, says the slowing economy is spurring both political sides towards negotiations.
The tentative moves on all sides over the last month to move towards negotiation has been pushed in the background by the business community, who is clearly very spooked by the signs of what has already happened in the first quarter and the prospect that it will get even worse. So I think the economy has become very important.
The Thai central bank says the prolonged political uncertainty contributed to slumps in domestic consumption, investment and tourism, with negative growth over the first 2 months in 2014. Asian Development Bank's Luxmon says the political standoff has had broad impact on the economy.
The bigger picture remains the same. I would say we say domestic consumption is not going to expand well or expand this year. Domestic investment does not look good either because investors are taking wait-and-see approach and because activities are not happening. So we say export is going to be a hero for this year. But all in all, less than 3% growth, that's definite for Thailand this year.
University of the Thai Chamber of Commerce economists also warn if the political standoff is prolonged into the second half of the year, more people will face redundancies, with some businesses already cutting working hours. International ratings agency Moody's Investor Services has recently warned an extension or escalation of the political turmoil would weaken Thailand's sovereign debt rating, translating into higher interest rates on government borrowings. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
For more on this and other stories, you can stop by our program page at voanews.com/daybreakasia. President Obama has returned home from a four-nation Asian trip aimed at reassuring allies in the region. Here in Washington itself, Asian nations have a variety of ways to connect with the United States. Those avenues of communication and cooperation have been building through the years, making Washington a unique vortex of global interaction. Kent Calder is director of the Reischauer Center for East Asian Studies at SAIS, part of Johns Hopkins University. He has long been fascinated with Washington's role as a power center and has shared his research in a new book titled Asia in Washington.
I think Washington itself is changing very, very fast. It's becoming a global capital far beyond simply the U.S. government. Another thing that was interesting to me, there are some Asian countries that are Washington-centric and some that are New York-centric. For example, Korea and China are quite Washington-centric. Japan, even though there's the Cherry Blossom Festival, which, of course, reminds a lot of people of the U.S.-Japan relationship, Japan is much more New York-centric. It's interesting to see all of the ways that different people promote their cultures in Washington. The cultural side, I think, is an important part of trans-Pacific understanding, and I was interested in how all of that happened. Sort of the classical model that we have is that lobbyists are the key people in Washington and in U.S. relations with the Pacific in particular. I found that that has really changed quite a lot recently, that we've moved to think tanks, the internet, the mass media. Those sorts of things are becoming more and more important. Washington is really becoming a global stage, and its relations with Asia and the world move very rapidly.
You have a lot of neat graphics in your book. One of them is a map of the Washington Information Complex, which shows the areas where the embassies are, the think tanks are, mass media, PR firms, multilateral organizations. Describe a little bit about all these different ways that Washington interacts with the world and Asia in particular.
Well, there's so much outside the government, exactly as you've said. There's the International Monetary Fund, there's the World Bank, there's the Inter-American Development Bank that funds Latin America. Even the Asian Development Bank has a big office. Three of the four top think tanks in the world are within about 300 yards of each other on Massachusetts Avenue. Then there's the big lobbying firms. Of course, several universities, Johns Hopkins, Georgetown, George Washington. And then the bureaus of a lot of the mass media, as well as the embassies, well over 150 different countries. So it's a tremendous variety, but it goes far, far beyond the U.S. government. And that's one of the main points I was making.
it's almost difficult to comprehend all these different entities interacting and directly engaging other countries. It's amazing that anybody can keep it all straight.
Well, you know, what I really found that was interesting is that even though it's complex, it's having some fairly clear but important effects on world affairs. If we take, for example, our trade policy, we've had large trade imbalances for the last 4 decades. Yet we have had really quite a mild response to the various trade crises. Also, of course, our alliances, generally speaking, have stayed quite consistent with countries around the region. What's happened outside the government has been relatively stabilizing. Also, we've got a lot of information about what's happening in the world. I think our decision-making generally has, even if occasionally we haven't been as decisive as sometimes people would like to see, it's been quite knowledgeable about how global forces are developing.
With the current policy of a rebalance or a pivot toward Asia, it's interesting that you write with the Washington factor in Asia that it was the hub of the hub-and-spoke security system that dominated international affairs in the Pacific and also Cold War policy. And, and here we come back to this pivot toward Asia and this military focus in the region.
Well, I think what we sometimes don't realize is how important the United States and particularly Washington looms for Asia. In particular, the countries of Asia have been outsiders in the international system generally, but in Washington, which is so multifaceted, has so many approach routes, it's been relatively easy for countries in Asia to become part of the global agenda. So I think the difficulties of access they have in some places, like in Europe or in Russia or Latin America, or even in parts of other Asian countries, it contrasts to Washington, which is pretty open, and if you're savvy and sophisticated, then you can get access on a global agenda through Washington.
That would seem to be what we would want, though, is a lot of open interaction back and forth in that access.
I do think that's right. Sometimes we don't appreciate the value to us of the way that Washington becomes such an important center. Every year we have all the finance ministers, a lot of the top politicians gathering together for the IMF and the World Bank meetings. We've had a global nuclear summit here. We've had the first of the G20 meetings here. And then a lot of people go to school here, or they just come through to visit and to network. Washington is a great place to meet people, to renew contacts, to gain inside information, as well as just talking to the U.S. government.
You also talk about outside of the Beltway, so to speak. Of course, inside of the Beltway is the term for Washington, D.C. proper. But outside of the Beltway, Asia across America and your chapter, The Changing Calculus, Asians have had a tremendous influence on this country, especially, too, on the West Coast.
Sure. Well, I'm glad that you mentioned that. I think this is something very important that many Americans don't realize, and across Asia, sometimes I think people don't understand how quickly the United States has been changing. Of course, we're a very diverse and dynamic country, I think, because of that diversity. But since 1965, when the Immigration Act was revised, we've seen a large increase in our Asian American population, which is now almost 5% of the total country. And in another 25 years or so, the projections are that it'll be close to 10% of America's population.
Kent Calder, director of the Reischauer Center for East Asian Studies at SAIS, Johns Hopkins University, and author of Asia in Washington, Exploring the Penumbra of Transnational Power. It's published by Brookings Institution Press. Guiding the complex penumbra of the latest world news, our own Steve Norman is up next with International Edition. We hope you stay tuned. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
To really understand what's happening today, take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington.
The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
It's one small step for man.
I have a dream.
The Beatles.